My guest today, Rebecca Gordon, is an old and dear friend from San Francisco who happens to epitomize what might be called a scholar activist. She currently teaches in the philosophy department at the University of San Francisco and for the university's Leo McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good. Her publications include Letters to Nicaragua, Cruel and Unusual, How Welfare Reform Punishes Poor People, and in 2016, America Nuremberg, The Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. Plus, she's a regular contributor to Tom's Dispatch. In 1984, Rebecca spent 6 months living in the war zones of Nicaragua, and in 1990, 3 months teaching desktop publishing in an anti-apartheid newspaper in Cape Town, South Africa, and 2 years before that, with her partner Jan, she had also taught me desktop publishing. Rebecca has also been involved in the movements for women's liberation, LGBT rights, movements in solidarity with the struggles of poor people in Central America, the anti-apartheid movement in the United States and South Africa, and the movements opposing U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's also a founder of Californians for Justice, a statewide organization dedicated to the political enfranchisement of marginalized people, especially young people, poor people, and people of color. We're looking for a guest to talk about the situation in Nicaragua and the responses to it among former supporters of the Sandinista Revolution. I came across an article she had written on the subject for Tom's Dispatch entitled Nicaragua at the Barricades and a Crossroads with an Ellipsis Between the Two Spaces and Places. It was what I was looking for, and so welcome once again, Rebecca Gordon, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Just so people know, I'm old. That's why I've done so many things.
Well, join the crowd. We're both old, and I've known you a good part of my life, and it's been a great pleasure to do that. You know, there are so many in the world, so many tragedies, but what makes what's happening in Nicaragua so special to us?
I'm really glad you asked that, Jeffrey, because it's a very good question. I mean, there are terrible things happening in places like Yemen, which is facing the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world right now. And in terms of numbers, there are many other places in the world where more people are being affected. But Nicaragua is special in the hearts of many people around the world, and including in this country and even in my very own neighborhood in the Mission District of San Francisco, because in the 1980s, the world was transfixed by the possibilities of a very small, very poor country in the middle of Central America throwing off the shackles of the dictator and trying to rebuild a country that would be both democratic and operating in the interests of the actual people who lived there. Hundreds of thousands of people from around the world, including from the United States, visited during that period. We were really overcome with what it meant to see people who had never been more than 50 miles from the place where they were born, who had this vision of the world or of their struggle as being something in their own community, in their own country, in the region of Central America, and then ultimately in the entire world. And they really saw the possibility of a new world. I'll never forget traveling in Contra country in the back of a pickup truck through mud that was up to our hubcaps and going by a barn that had this huge painted graffiti on it that said, "Nosotros vencimos, nunca volveremos a ser esclavo." And it was written in almost illiterate Spanish with all the S's missing because you don't actually pronounce them in Nicaraguan Spanish. But what it means is we have won. We are never going back to being slaves. And that's exactly what I think is the spirit that we are seeing right now in the uprising that's taking place in Nicaragua, ironically against one of the leaders of that revolution, that insurrection that took place in 1978 and 1979, so many years ago. We're seeing that same spirit of liberation now in young people, in campesinos, in people in small towns all over the country, once again picking up the very paving stones that were made in Somoza's factory and building barricades. And it's incredibly sad. It's incredibly sad. And the response in this country is exactly the response in Nicaragua, which is that it has split in half the people who together share a desire for a free and prosperous and happy Nicaragua here on the left in the United States and in families that I know in Nicaragua, Nicaraguan families here. The split is right down the middle, and it's incredibly painful.
It's also a situation like we see in Venezuela, where Chavez and Chavismo became an inspiration, and then through a number of economic disasters and bad choices and the collapse of oil prices and Chavez's death, the split has been there. And we see people here, some who've never been to Venezuela, arguing back and forth whose fault it is, whether the Venezuelan or in this case, is it the Americans trying to interfere again in Nicaragua? But you write about the importance of recognizing that people other than Americans have agency. Talk about that.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, for some people, it has cost a huge intellectual effort, especially in the early part of their lives, to really come to the realization that the lies they were taught in school about the United States as the great liberating savior of the world were just that, lies. And we've made this tremendous effort to understand just how many places all over the world the United States, with its secret forces, its Joint Special Operations Command, its illegal wars, we've taken in all of that, and it sometimes makes it impossible to remember that other people also can do things. Other people have their own agency, their own history, their own trajectories, and that not everybody who opposes a party that is still named Sandinista is a puppet of the United States of the Americas, of America. And it's absolutely true that the U.S., some tiny portion of it, which is still paying attention to Central America, that the advantage of what's going on in Nicaragua today. But that doesn't mean that the people on the streets who are being killed by the police and these paramilitary gangs, it doesn't mean that those people are being paid by the CIA or that they are simply fools who have been fooled by the CIA. They are people who respond to an actual situation in their own country. It's, you know, part of the problem is we have this binary thinking, right? If the United States is one, then the other side must be our friends. If the United States wants to illegally invade Iraq, then Saddam Hussein must be a wonderful ruler. It's possible that both things are true, that both Saddam Hussein was a dictator who was incredibly cruel in the way that he repressed his people, and the United States invasion of Iraq was a terrible, terrible crime, a war crime. Both those things can be true. Similarly, the United States, for whatever reason, might oppose Daniel Ortega, and good people on the left might also oppose Daniel Ortega. And it's just very hard, I think, for people to get beyond that either-or, black-white kind of thinking. The world is way more complicated than that.
Well, tell us about what happened with the Sandinistas after they dropped from power. As you write, Nicaraguan people realized that as long as the Sandinistas were in power, that the United States would not allow the people to live and enjoy their lives without being attacked by the Contras. So what happened with the Sandinistas when they left power?
Okay. So first, a lot of people may not even know the original history. So very quickly, in 1979 was the culmination of an insurrection that threw out Anastasio Somoza, who was a dictator and his uncle before him had been supported for many years by the United States. At that time, the Sandinistas made a decision that they were not going to prosecute all the members of of Somoza's private army, which was essentially the National Guard, and they allowed people to make a decision about whether they wanted to stay and work to construct a new Nicaragua or they wanted to leave. And many of them did, in fact, leave, and most of them went up to Honduras, which lies to the north of Nicaragua, where the CIA and various right-wing forces from Argentina and other places created this military force called the Contra, or the counter, stands for counter-revolutionaries. And they instigated a terrible war whose military strategy was terrorism, was torture, kidnapping, massacres of unarmed civilians in the countryside. And this war had gone on for many years. So in 1990, elections took place in accord with the new constitution that the Sandinistas had brought in. And something amazing happened for the first time that I know of in history. A revolutionary party was voted out of power and they actually left. And there was a peaceful transition to a center-right coalition. But, and this is where we're getting to, in that period between the election and the inauguration, a period of a number of months, occurred an event that was called La Piñata. And you know, a piñata is one of those toys that when you hit it and it breaks open, all the goodies fall out for you to pick up. So unfortunately, the Sandinistas and various individuals within the party treated the Nicaraguan government coffers like a piñata. And they took houses, vehicles, money, state-owned companies, and essentially appropriated them for themselves. And at the time, there were people here on the left who said, oh, well, you have to understand that they suffered all those years in the mountains, and they have been giving, you know, sacrificing for the country all these years, and they have nothing of their own. So this is their chance to, you know, just take a little bit of something so that they can survive as individuals having sacrificed for Nicaragua all these years. But what happened was that money and those goods became essentially capital for the party to rebuild itself and for individuals, and especially Daniel Ortega and his wife Rosario Murillo, to reconstitute themselves as wealthy and as a powerful political force in the country. What happened then was, after the center-right coalition lost the elections in 1996 to a much further right candidate, a man named Arnaldo Alemán, a real hard right person, he was actually taken out of power, and or he was voted out of power, but he was convicted quite properly of corruption and was sentenced to house arrest. Well, at that time, what was left of the Sandinista party, and the party itself had undergone some real splits. There had been an internal fight about party democracy, and the more democratic forces, from my point of view, lost that fight. This is a lot of inside baseball stuff. But so what happened was that Daniel Ortega and the FSLN, the Sandinistas, made what is called el pacto, a truce with Alemán and the right wing of Nicaragua. At the same time, Daniel Ortega and his wife Rosario seem to have undergone some kind of religious conversion to a form of charismatic Catholicism. And so they became very close to parts of the church hierarchy, especially, and the church, just like everything else in Nicaragua, was split down the middle. And so on the right, you had people like Cardinal Obando y Bravo, who had supported the Contras all through the Contra War and who had been made a cardinal by Pope John Paul II. So he had always been an enemy of the revolution. Well, he became great friends with Rosario and Daniel. And in consequence of their conversion, Nicaragua has one of the harshest and most enforced anti-abortion laws in the world, and certainly in the Americas. And so essentially what began to happen is that even though there's still all this revolutionary rhetoric and the language of revolution, the reality was the alliances that Daniel and his Sandinistas were making were actually alliances on the right. And in fact, the proximate cause, the thing that spurred these current demonstrations were changes that he made to the Social Security law. And the reason he had to make those changes was that essentially they had, the FSLN had to some extent, it looks like, pretty much plundered the Social Security coffers. And the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which was offering new loans to Nicaragua, said you have to clean up the Social Security funds. And so what Ortega brought in was a law that raised the Social Security taxes, which annoyed private enterprise as well as ordinary people, and at the same time reduced Social Security benefits, which affected old people and ordinary people in Nicaragua. Nobody liked that. And so then all of a sudden you have this coalition of students who are mostly democratic forces and more or less on the left, and organizations like COSEP, which is the equivalent of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce representing private industry on the right, making common alliance in this Alliance for Democracy and Justice, that is sort of the group that has come together as a kind of amorphous, it's more a name than a group, but to oppose Daniel Ortega. So the FSLN of today is not the Frente Sandinista of the 1980s or the 1970s. It is a very different organization. The problem that I see is that when Somoza left power, was thrown out of power in 1979, the FSLN was ready and organized. They were prepared to take over governance. And initially, they governed in coalition with other very similar forces, other private industry forces. So initially, that was their, they had a coalition, and eventually other forces left that coalition. But they stepped in on, you know, the insurrection ended July 19th, July 20th. It seems like they stepped in with their plans to improve the life of ordinary Nicaraguans. By 1981, they had wiped out polio. They had a literacy campaign which brought down the illiteracy rate tremendously in the course of a very few years. They established clinics. They made public education free up through the university level. They did all of these things that they had planned to do for many years. They were ready to govern. What I don't see today is any kind of organized group with a vision for the future of Nicaragua that is ready even to compete in new elections if they were to succeed in the demand that there be new elections sooner than the next elections are scheduled to take place. I don't see a similar organized group that is ready to take over the government of Nicaragua in the same way that the Sandinistas were in 1979. And so this is my fear, that the country could devolve into, well, it's already, you know, murderous chaos. And that is just so, so painful.
My guest is Rebecca Gordon. As you guessed, we were talking about the situation in Nicaragua. I recall that during the Contra Wars, a governor from Arkansas, William Jefferson Clinton, sent his National Guard down to Honduras essentially to train Contras there, which attracted a brief flurry of comment in the press and then disappeared. But that is obviously Honduras and the U.S. role in Honduras, which has played a major role in having so many refugees from Honduras today trying to seek political asylum in the United States. Perhaps you could talk about that role in Nicaragua, Honduras, and what happened there.
Well, yes. I mean, this is very important. And one of my dearest friends in the world is a Honduran who had to leave during the 80s precisely because of the danger of the essentially military government at that time, which the U.S. was supporting in return for allowing them to basically run this war from Honduras's southern part, Nicaragua's, you know, right to the north of Nicaragua. And yes, in fact, my friend's partner a woman named Inez Garcia was actually the only person who was ever disappeared in Honduras who was actually reappeared because she had the good fortune to have a German mother and the German government got involved. But yes, the United States has long treated Honduras as its launching pad for wars in Central America and for the Contra War. And more recently, you may recall that during the Obama administration, when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, there was a coup in Honduras. And in the first days, the U.S. spoke out against the coup, but very quickly that line changed, and Hillary Clinton's State Department made it very clear that they actually supported the coup because the man who had been deposed was too much on the left for them. And so what my Honduran friends say is that the situation in Honduras today, between the interpenetration of the government and the narcotics cartels and the resurgence of the military as essentially a ruling power in Honduras, has made that country more of a hell than it even was in the 1980s. And this is indeed one of the reasons why people are desperately leaving Honduras and trying to come to the United States. I have a friend here who has just been told that he can apply for asylum after living essentially illegally in the U.S. for 19 months. He now is going to one day, and God knows when, have an asylum hearing after he left Honduras at the threat of his life. So, yes, U.S. policy absolutely is responsible for creating the terror in countries like Honduras. The one thing I will say about Nicaragua is that I was in Nicaragua last October, and I will say that the level of development way out in the countryside where I was is definitely very different from what it was 9 or 10 years ago. Roads are being built. People have access to cellular technology, which has allowed them to leapfrog landlines, and people whose parents and grandparents really had no contact with the outside world are now connected to the entire world through the internet. And it is a big change, and it's a change that's not going to go back. However, the other thing that was really clear is that unlike the rest of Central America, Nicaragua has escaped being a center of drug trafficking. There are people who say that the reason for that is that Daniel Ortega basically made a pact with the cartels that they can move their shipments up and down the Atlantic coast through the water in return for not doing anything inside Nicaragua itself. Honestly, I don't know why Nicaragua has not been plagued by the drug cartels the same way that the rest of Central America has been. But I will say that that is one thing that has been good for the country, and it worries me that in the current chaos, it's possible that there might be an entry point for the cartels, although I don't know that they need Nicaragua when they have the corridors they already have. So that's a long answer, roundabout answer to your question, but...
No, it's a good answer. I mean, the other two countries who have been sending candidates or hoping for political asylum, El Salvador and Guatemala, have also a history of U.S. intervention that most Americans aren't aware of and they don't learn about in their school books. But El Salvador, with MS-13, is a totally American product.
Absolutely.
And that's never discussed. It's like, where did these gangs come from? You know, maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Yes, the MS-13 and the Salvadoran gangs are essentially a U.S. export, just like Coca-Cola. And in fact, in 1993, I was in El Salvador. It was the December of 93, the first year that the that the FMLN, the Guerrilla force there, had decided that instead of boycotting the elections, they were going to participate in the elections. And I was sent down with my partner, Jan, and a couple of other people to do some training for some of the comandantes of the FMLN in how to do a house-to-house electoral campaign, which is, of course, very different from fighting a guerrilla war. So that was very interesting. But while we were there in San Salvador, I literally saw the same graffiti from my local block-level gang in the Mission District on houses in San Salvador, because people who had been living here during the height of the war in El Salvador were now going back, and they were bringing back with them the gangs. And this is the MS-13 is actually a gang that originated in Los Angeles in the Salvadoran refugee community there. And when people went back to El Salvador, they brought with them this whole gang structure, and the cartels were quite happy to take advantage of that and use it as a distribution and enforcement arm here in the United States. But it's absolutely something that happened here precisely because people were here because of the wars that the United States was creating in their home countries, in El Salvador and Guatemala. And there's no question that the refugee crisis in Central America is rooted in U.S. policy in Central America.
And, well, the U.S. policy in Central America has this a long and ugly history. This morning, I was just going back over things I remembered. In 1927, U.S. Marines were very proud to have introduced dive bombing to modern warfare in fighting against Sandino's forces. And this is something that that students don't learn in the schools. In 1854, in July of 1854, there was a town on the East Coast called Greytown. That was the English name for it. And it was burned to the ground by the U.S. Navy for one of a number of reasons, insulting U.S. ambassador, but it turns out it was to make way for business prospects for two American businessmen. So the whole of Central America, it has a long and ugly history and experience with America. And I wonder what they think down there when they hear that America is the leader of the free world.
That is a really interesting question. And I suspect that, you know, just like the rest of the world, some people believe the propaganda and believe that the U.S. is the leader of the free world. And many people also know what I've always thought, which is that Central America does best when the United States is distracted and is focusing its attention on some other part of the world. But, you know, the whole concept of the free world, you have to remember, is a Cold War concept. And the idea was that the United States represented the free world in distinction to the communist world, the world that was dominated by the Soviet Union. Well, we no longer have a Soviet Union in this world, so I have to wonder what it is now that the free world, that expression means, in contrast to what? In contrast to dictatorships, in contrast to Putin's Russia? What is the free world today? But in any case, I think that a lot of people in Nicaragua are pretty clear that the U.S. is not our friend. On the other hand, I think it's also very easy, just as it's easy for people in this country to not know very much about what's going on somewhere else, to form a connection with one or two individuals in another country who become sort of your interpreter of that country, and to think that because you're hearing from this one or two people that you understand and can make good judgments about who represents what forces in that other country. So when, for example, a few students came from the Autonomous University in Managua, came up to Washington, they were actually photographed with Rubio and Cruz and, you know, these other right-wing members of the U.S. Congress who were supporting them against Daniel Ortega, and it's quite possible that they did not have the sophistication about U.S. politics to know who it was that they were being pictured with. And this is, of course, also the risk for those of us here in the United States who are trying to understand what's happening in Nicaragua, that, you know, we need to have a little humility, because even if we were there on the ground, we would only be seeing what we can see. But from this distance, all we can do is know who the people are that we're talking to, know what our long-term relationships with them have been, know that they are people that we can trust, and listen to what they have to say. But the reality is, you know, me sitting here in San Francisco, I can't tell you exactly what's happening in Monimbo or Masaya or Waslala or any of those places in Nicaragua. I can only tell you what people I know and trust have told me. But it's a very different thing than seeing it with your own eyes. So I think we need all of us, especially those who are so convinced that Daniel Ortega today represents the same trajectory, the same forces, the same hopes that he represented in 1979. I think we need to be a little careful about not assuming that that's true.
Well, I'm not sure what he represented all back then. I remember he came to the United Nations to speak, and he and his wife went and spent $2,300 on designer sunglasses before, while they were there, at a time when people in the country were collecting money to buy pencils for Nicaraguan school children, and at a meeting.
I do remember.
A meeting in New York. But Ortega was speaking at, a friend of mine who was there, actually Ron Kovic was there, and he told me that someone in the audience asked Ortega how he could go, he and his wife could go and spend $2,300 on designer sunglasses when the people, the students in Nicaragua needed their school supplies, and the answer was, he didn't have to answer. The other people in the audience shouted down the person who asked the question.
Right.
And that is a problem
right.
of the left. And it was a problem then.
Yes.
And it's something we need to remember today. I actually remember one of the great Sandinistas, Ernesto Cardenal, at the Women's Building some mm-hmm. years back. Someone asked him what he thought of the Sandinistas, and his voice rolled out, and he shouted, "God damn the Sandinistas!" People were really shocked, but Cardenal was one, a great poet, and he who never sold out.
Yes.
Is there anything
yes.
you hear from him today? He must be very old by now. Very.
He is very old. I saw him actually a year. 2 years ago, he came to the University of San Francisco, where I teach, and I ended up, sort of by mistake, being invited to a tea before he made his public talk with the president of the university and various faculty members. And at the time, he was talking especially about the plan to build this huge boondoggle to build a canal across Nicaragua to rival the Panama Canal, and he was very, very much opposed to that. He thought it was a corrupt boondoggle, and B, very destructive of the natural environment all over the route of the canal, and C, was displacing many communities, especially indigenous communities, on the route of the canal, and he spoke very firmly about it. And he talked a little bit about the situation. He was careful because he didn't know who he was talking to and in what context. But he did make it really clear that he was not happy with the current government. And you know, his relationship, especially with Rosario Murillo, Daniel's wife, goes back all the way to the 1980s, when there was a real split among the community of artists who were all working with the revolution, but they had very different ideas about the role of art in a revolution. So Ernesto Cardenal's idea in the Ministry of Culture was that everyone could be an artist, everyone, that Nicaragua was, as its tagline always has been, the country of poets, and that everyone could write poetry. And he did poetry workshops all over the country with campesinos, with poor people, with young people, in which people got the idea that, oh my gosh, I myself can make art, that culture is something that arises from the people, which is what anthropologists mean when they talk about culture. And so he is also responsible for the famous colony of people who became beautiful painters on the island of Solentiname in Lake Nicaragua. On the other side was Rosario Murillo, who represented the union of professional artists. And her idea was that the role of arts in the revolution was that professionals would be creating the professional representations, the posters, the music, the all of the ways that art was, as the slogan used to be. There was a slogan that people used to shout, Cultura es, fusil artístico de la revolución, which means culture is the art weapon of the revolution. And so there was this real disagreement. Is culture something that's created by professionals, or is culture something that rises up from the people, that is the expression of ordinary people?
And that, and so dear Rebecca, yeah. We have come to the end of the hour. I want to thank you so much, Rebecca Gordon, for being our guest today on Takes on the World. And I'll see you on the big line. I assume there's going to be a protest and a rally on behalf of keeping families together in San Francisco this weekend. I know we're having one.
I believe that's right.
We're having one here in Ukiah this Saturday. The last one attracted 300 people. Marchers are gathering at Pear Tree Plaza at 11 o'clock and going to Perkins, Perkins of the Courthouse for a rally at noon. I'll be there, I'm sure. There'll be one happening in San Francisco. Rebecca, thanks so much for being our guest today. I really appreciate
it. It was a real pleasure.
Take care and give my best to Jan.
I will.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.